Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It is the 4th of December today. You're listening to this on the 5th of December, 2017. And this is a year I'm happy to see go. I think a bunch of you are too. Again, I ask you to donate to this show and keep me going full time. Many of you know my problems and struggles with taxes and other things. And it keeps me going. And not merely the money, but also the fact that people are willing to sacrifice a few dollars for my sake is one of the things that keeps me going emotionally. And that's always a struggle for a lot of us. Being a part of this movement, or nationalist, or Orthodox, or whatever, you know, puts us on the fringes. And, you know, like Socrates, Christ, the prophets, we're all in the same boat. And we're going to be treated the same. We cannot expect to be treated well by a system that we have rejected. And it's rejected us as well. Anybody who this system loves is more than likely an enemy, or is under temptation. And that's how it is. But today, I want to do something. People keep asking me this. And I want to talk about the Russian so-called hacking scandal. This is one of the most desperate, pathetic political issues I have come across in my 27 years, actually 28 years now, of full-time research into this stuff. The left was humiliated by a man who never should have won the nomination, let alone the presidency, who was self-financed all the way through and therefore can't be controlled. That's different maybe when he got into office. But the presidency is not a dictator. He cannot, you know, bring relief and revolution to the society. He has to satisfy many powerful elites to function. We have a tendency to personalize power, because we're naturally monarchists, and we often put our own fathers in place and make a connection between political rule and family rule. That's the part of the natural law. Romans recognize that. Of course, the church has always recognized that. Only liberalism destroys it, and the killing of the king ritual is part of that destruction. And we want to see these people as victors, you know, with the Roman garland and bringing about this counter-revolution that will restore everything. Well, one man doesn't have that power. Keep something in mind, and please, if you get anything from my work, you know, it's one of the axioms that I've, in my almost 30 years now of doing this, academically and otherwise, that I discovered is that politicians have very little power. Politicians in a republic are there to take the heat off of the real power, which is capital. Capital, whether it be, you know, commercial or media, industrial, financial. And today, it's really the same small group of people, very disproportionately Jewish. But of course, as always, they can't rule openly. It's increasingly becoming the case that they're more and more shameless. But they need institutions to hide behind. As I've said many times before, the Medicis in Florence created that blueprint. In that they would maintain the old so-called Republican ideals of oligarchical Florence, but rule as a banking clan behind the scenes. But the problem is, republicanism and the Renaissance were oligarchical institutions. They're for the rich, by the rich. The Medici family financed the entire Florentine and really the Northern Italian Renaissance. And bringing in Kabbalah and later become the Rosicrucian and Masonic orders into prominence, this was their great revolutionary idea. They created that spark, not to get too esoteric or arcane, but the spark that was to make the modern world very different from all other civilizations that had come before it. Ancient civilizations were far from primitive, and yet they didn't make smartphones. Why is that? There was one thing missing, and that was the Judaic, Kabbalistic, Masonic idea that somehow this small elite is not subject to natural forces. Everyone else is. These are the golden people, turning lead into gold, Saturn into the sun. But it's a small group. In the pentagram, it's the point on top. The other four points are, of course, the four points of the compass, or the four symbolic elements. And now you're not just, you know, working with nature, but you are trying to replace it altogether. The point of it all is, of course, that by now, you know, we live in a society that is totally unprecedented. The Orthodox Church has never, ever, ever got involved in end-time stuff. You know, the Protestants, every 5 minutes, they're the new end-time prophecy. And they go through the Bible and they you know, try to, add up numbers and try to come to the precise year as if numbers in the Bible are just numerals of things. Shows you the sola scriptura and the way that these ignoramuses and how they've destroyed things. You know, importing modern sensibilities into ancient texts. They have no right reading. Because really what they're looking for is what they want to hear. We cannot import modern sensibilities, which are revolutionary, which derive from this so-called alchemical spark, the Kabbalah, into the Bible. And I want you guys to remember that the Soviet Union created not only liberal Orthodox groups, as I said some time ago, also conservatives. They created a left-right spectrum. Didn't last long, but we talked about this on St. Tikhon last time. Politicians have very little power. The Russia hacking scandal is such an embarrassment. I really feel dirty talking about it. It is so ignorant. It is so low. It is so... It's a way that the regime gets to rub our noses and what little power we have. Donald Trump wasn't supposed to win. They tried to kill him four times during the, since he announced his candidacy. Corporate America went wild. Because, you know, one of his first points of the platform was a very popular notion of slightly slowing the massive influx of cheap labor into America. So much of what's left of the American economy, like any oligarchy, is dependent on essentially slave labor, which is what this is. And it really was quite moderate, but I have never seen in all my years this level of viciousness and unbridled hatred. And one of the worst aspects of this is that the nationalist movement is so immature, has so little money, that we simply don't have the institutions or the intellectual backbone, foundation, to really support him and really have any kind of nationalist presence at all. The hacking scandal, of course, has nothing to do with computer hacking. I said this on Daily Traditionalists in other places, but I haven't gone through it systematically at all. There's really only one thing to mention, and that is that the NSA has a report on the so-called hacking scandal. We talk about the concept of the deep state. I've said this before as well. What we mean is you know, we're talking about as much private sector forces as state forces. That's why I object to the term, because it's not state. Americans really, really struggle with the notion that all power in America is private, including so-called public power. The difference between Putin and Trump or any American president is that Putin is stronger and more popular than the oligarchs. In America, the oligarchs create the president. Remember, though, that Vladimir Putin was initially financed by the Jewish oligarchs. And then once he was elected, he ripped up their little contract and did as he pleased, making himself the most hated man in the regime, but one of the most popular men of the 21st century. I can say the same for Lukashenko in Belarus. Not only did you have the humiliation, I mean, the Democrats, you know, I don't believe in parties left and right. This is all smoke and mirrors. We all know this. But Hillary, you know, stole the nomination. Democrats were excited about Bernie Sanders, not this crotchety establishmentarian. And once, you know, it was stolen from him, there wasn't the enthusiasm. We all realize that Hillary's auditoriums were empty. On Facebook and Twitter, Donald Trump had 3-4 times the number of likes and members and his pages than Hillary did. No one was excited for her, including her own people. And yet every single solitary news outlet said that not only will Hillary win, but it is absolutely certain that Hillary will win. And the point is, of course, to create a fait accompli. But impressively enough, that, you know, I'm a big critic of the American population and the American middle class, but this election showed that there is another side to them. And they need to be very, very careful. The regime needs to be very, very careful. These people were threatened with death. I've seen it. We've all seen it on YouTube by these disgusting illegals and rich white leftists, females and feminized male things, whatever they are. And yet they didn't care. As I've said many times, the election was totally invalid by any standard because the regime, the elites in corporate capital, and the far left shut down and attempted to destroy Trump's campaign, shutting down rallies, making sure he can't speak, you know, rioting, this kind of thing. That is, you know, you can't do that. That's a felony, a long prison. You try to keep someone from voting, you keep someone from supporting their candidate. That's a very serious offense. And even very lackadaisically, but even Obama had to come out and say, settle down. Well, I've always compared Trump to 1972, Nixon McGovern. The only difference there was that everyone knew McGovern was going to be destroyed. In both cases, though, the more or less conservative candidate humiliated the left. The left in America exists purely because of corporate capital and academia. Academia itself exists because of corporate capital and the state. The state exists from banking capital. You know, it couldn't function 5 seconds without that kind of liquidity coming in from the banks. It was essentially all oligarchical, one way or another. Foundations give other foundations, and they launder their money so that by the time it gets to these rioting groups, it's really hard to trace. And that's done on purpose. And the notion that, you know, no one lost their jobs because they were absolutely certain that Hillary was going to win, even though her rallies were empty. She was not popular even in her own party. And foreign polls of the American people show Hillary at 11, 12, 13%. And that's pretty much, I'm sure, what she got of the popular vote. I also want to stress the notion that the Electoral College, you know, I'm no fan of the Constitution or America or anything like that, but the Electoral College was a brilliant concept. You know, the Constitution was this patchwork quilt of compromises, which I suppose is you know, rational. you have to satisfy different points of view. But the regime wants to destroy the Electoral College. One of the ways it does this is by keeping it as mysterious as possible. Because ultimately what would happen is that the only people who would ever go out and vote are those in the big city. If you lived in Wyoming, there's no point. You know, I wouldn't bother to vote. It would be a permanent liberal leftist oligarchy. Sort of what we have now, but just, you know, without the pageantry. And without the occasional monkey wrench in the works. I wanted to call on nationalists to stop, whenever something good happens, stop then immediately. For some reason, you guys are throwing dirt at the person. Someone wins an election, someone does well, someone has money, and somehow they are automatically agents. No evidence is ever given. So Putin's an agent and Trump's an agent. And all that. Shut up. Take what you can get. You know, whenever someone is successful in the nationalist movement, they come under attack. This isn't the state doing this. They don't care. They're not going to waste resources on us. It's our own people. So anyway, the NSA, I read this months ago, actually quite a while ago, and this report, and it just this gets to the heart of American politics. It gets to the heart of how oligarchy works and how it works since Nimrod to today. The NSA says the following. Russia's state-run propaganda machine, comprised of its domestic media apparatus, outlets targeting global audiences such as RT and Sputnik, and a network of quasi-government trolls, contributed to the influence campaign by serving as a platform for Kremlin messaging to Russian international audiences, end quote. That's what they mean by hacking. So not only is it the most absurd way to throw a temper tantrum because their girl lost by a massive margin, but it's not even a hacking scandal. I want to remind you guys that in 1997, 1996, Russia was disappearing. The economy was liquidating. 80% of the Soviet economy was liquidated in that period of time, from 1991 to 97. There was no military chain of command. No one was collecting taxes. No one was showing up for the draft. And crime lords with American money were carving out their fiefs in these regional governorships, having their own security, private security, and some, you know, cops on the payroll as well. As I've said many times, the Russian life expectancy for males went down to 58. Russia was disappearing. And of course, the regime is cheering here until Putin was appointed by Yeltsin. From 2000 to 2017, Russia has gone from a fourth world backwater with really no functional economy, a military in shambles, really no functional society at all, to the seventh largest economy in the world, and apparently so powerful that its newspapers are capable of altering elections globally. Of course, this is an example of Johnson's Law. The average American, the average educated American, knows nothing about Russia, knows nothing about Putin. He's kind of this shadowy nationalist figure and therefore evil. He has a kind of a look about him. There's a KGB. You know, all these images and emotional symbols get mixed up in their mind, and they spit out this general contempt. So he's a perfect target. And Russia's large, and it's just this big black spot in the American consciousness. And so it's very easy, with that kind of ignorance, they can get away with pretty much anything. The claim that he's worth, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. I have to laugh. How would they know that? What, did he turn over his tax returns? Well, why would he admit that? If he's that powerful, has that much money, how would anyone ever find out how much it's worth? He's not going to declare it to anybody. It's made up. It's myth. I think I told you in the lecture on the murder of the Romanov family, the Tsar and his family ended up really dead in terms of cash on hand, very little money. Remember, the royal family had given everything they had to the war effort. The women took a crash course in nursing and were at the front between 17 and 20 hours a day, working as what we would call today like practical nurses or nurse assistants. And many observers said that Alexandra, the empress, worked so hard and for so long that she hurt her health. That's usually not mentioned in the very poor English language history textbooks that are out there. So with this kind of ignorance, it's very easy to take a guy like Vladimir Putin, who is, you know, kind of like this James Bond villain in the public mind, and have him somehow be responsible through Russia Today and Sputnik and these newspapers, controlling American minds. That's the hacking scandal. There was no, you know, ripping open the mainframe of some computer company somewhere. This is what else the NSA says. It's almost embarrassing to say. Quote, the Kremlin's principal international propaganda outlet, Russia Today, has collaborated with WikiLeaks. The editor-in-chief visited WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in London in August of 2013, where they discussed renewing his broadcast contact with RT, according to Russian and Western media. Russian media subsequently announced that RT had become the only Russian media company to partner with WikiLeaks and had received access to new leaks of secret information. RT routinely gives Assange sympathetic coverage and provides him a platform to denounce the United States. End quote. All they said in that poorly written paragraph is that Russia Today is engaging in investigative journalism. But for the NSA to talk about a controlled media is so twisted and ironic. I have a backache right now. My feet hurt. It is so outrageous. But none of this has anything to do with hacking. The definition of the term normally is when a computer operator, through some dishonest method, gains access to a protected database. But that's not the issue at all. But the writer of this report would have had to show quite a bit of data, showing the footprint and how you could trace it back to different places. As if someone that skilled would leave a footprint. The very fact that American media don't even ask that very obvious and simple question show you the level that we're dealing with here. It really is. It's depressing in the sense that it proves for anybody who's on the fence just how ridiculous liberal democracy is and how tightly controlled it is. Now, on the other hand, you see that Hillary stealing the nomination from Bernie in Arizona. Arizona newspapers showed a substantial Bernie lead over HRC with no exceptions. Dozens of polling places in that state were shut down arbitrarily for no good reason, forcing very long lines elsewhere. All of a sudden, they simply shut down every other polling station. No one's entirely sure why. But they directed them to another one, so they can't say that they're suppressing a vote, but they get to the other one and the line is out the door. WikiLeaks dumped about 20,000 emails from the DNC showing that, you know, this is something that was planned. But the hard evidence you would see from exit polls. You know, it's like Putin in the elections. Putin is one of the most powerful popular men in Russia. Why in heaven's name would he have to steal an election? Only unpopular people do. And that his approval rating is roughly the same as his party's share of the vote shows that it's all honest. So what are the exit polls now for Bernie? And that's really, it's coming out of Arizona, just one state. It was overwhelming. And this was the problem with WikiLeaks. How this partnership with WikiLeaks somehow makes RT, you know, ominous. I can't make sense out of it. I really doubt that the writer of this thing made sense out of it. He was simply doing what he was told, or they. But the argument as it stands, and this is the official report on the so-called hacking, it doesn't make sense at any level. It's not hacking. And the arguments simply are that Russia Today, WikiLeaks, these, you know, these media companies are opposing American policy. That is the same thing as stealing an election. This is the people that we're dealing with here. One document that WikiLeaks got from the DNC says, yes, Super PAC paying young voters to push back online to Sanders supporters. She wasn't a popular candidate in her own party. Even Moody's, the credit rating agency that the economy depends on, predicted Hillary's massive victory. Not only did all major U.S. media predict her victory, but by a massive landslide. The election consortium founder, Sam Wang at Princeton, said Hillary had a 99% chance of winning the election, and this was common. These people are still working. How come they didn't lose their jobs? But because they had created this hype that Hillary's going to be the next president and she's going to win, 90% of the vote, they were humiliated when it didn't work out. So they needed to create something that, Americans were hypnotized by Russia Today, which essentially is what they're arguing. It was the Washington Post, who of course endorsed Hillary and is very close to the CIA, stated that the election was stolen by Russian hackers. It was a means of regaining credibility. The first article about this gave no evidence and didn't define what hacking is. It was simply sensationalist. At the very least, though, the Washington Post went through all the American elections, or the elections abroad that the U.S. disrupted. But in those cases, there's actual evidence. To see the power of a Jewish and Israeli money and authority in the American press, the billions from the Gulf monarchies that went to Hillary, not a problem. But because Russia Today is working with WikiLeaks, well, that shows you just how powerful that coalition is. And I'm going to tell you right now, some of the stock at RT is owned by the state. But in no way does that imply that Putin decides what's on the front page. The American government is deep into the Washington Post, so I don't see the difference. But you know what? Let's say they're right. Russia would be absolutely right to work for Donald Trump's victory. Because on October 11th of 16, Hillary said that she will go to war with Russia. And this year, after the election was over, she said war is called for. And same thing for Iran. She said, I want the Iranians to know if I'm president, we will attack Iran. Now, Iran, of course, is the key Russian and Chinese ally in Central Asia. Roughly 1 million illegal aliens voted for Hillary. But the real significance here isn't in how laughable this claim is. It's that it is so infantile and that it's an actual issue. You know, the American empire is crumbling at any wedge. I mean, there's a million different ways to bring it down. And this is where these people have the universities of the world at their disposal. They have every major newspaper at their disposal. We're talking about the elite, bankers and financiers. They have all the intellectuals under their thumb. They have research institutes all over the place. They control the intellectual pulse of academics. And that's what they come up with? Well, something significant here, and I'm using this as a foil to get into what in the heck happened in Russia. I got involved in political science and history because the Berlin Wall came down. I think I've said this before, but I watched Ceausescu getting executed on TV on Christmas Day 1989, and I signed up. I had been a musician up until that point, And I said, you know, music just seems kind of trite now when you have this colossal empire falling to pieces with no blood. But it made it completely unprecedented. Solzhenitsyn was very worried about this because obviously he's no friend of the USSR, but he did not want the party to be banned, and he didn't want the structures to be totally destroyed right away. It needed to slowly change. He believes in more of a Chinese model, which has been wildly successful. Now, let's be very clear, and I'll say this to the day I die. American foreign policy has never been anti-communist. Never. Communism as an ideology has never been a problem. It is deep in the American apparatus. It's deep in American academics. It's everywhere. The United States created the USSR. I don't mean the government. I mean private sources. And built the heavy industry of the Soviet Union. Henry Ford created their industry. Their automotives. Major American steel firms took care of their steel. Amoco, the Rockefellers, took care of the oil. GE took care of the electric. Anthony Sutton has the actual receipts and orders bringing the money from one place to another with American workers, because you didn't have a whole lot of skilled Russian labor after the slaughter of World War I and the Civil War. And I keep saying this too, Americans really didn't ever know what Marxism was. They couldn't define its key terms. And certainly they don't know what Leninism or Bolshevism is. And definitely not in 1918. There was absolutely no hostility to Bolshevism at all because, it was very, almost completely unknown. And importantly, it seemed to suggest what they really wanted. Wilson and his crew wanted a centralized Russian government that can serve as a check to Germany. There is one enemy of capitalism. There is one enemy of the American empire. There is one enemy, period, and that's nationalism. Nationalism is all that matters. Whenever a communist country became nationalist in its general approach to the world, especially one as big as Russia, suddenly it became a problem. Woodrow Wilson occasionally would and his successors, Hoover, would say things like, oh, he's acting like a czar, talking about Lenin or Trotsky. It was almost a symbol, virtue signaling, that when we oppose the Soviet, we're not really opposing the Soviet Union, but you can't be resurrecting czarism in your activities. I've seen this over and over again. Otherwise, it's fine. Where these writers are getting, there's really no one who's saying this in mainstream life, but where these writers are getting the notion that American intellectuals and Americans in government and military knew what Bolshevism was in 1918 is laughable. Russians didn't know what it was in 1918. You can't have a Cold War when the two warring parties, or any kind of, you can't have a war where two warring parties are trading with each other on a regular basis. Trade between China and Taiwan is illegal. That's a war. No one really gave a damn about state-run economies. It depends on how you define state. In America, it would be this banking elite that then would bring everything under its control and rule America from one place. That is the absolute apogee. That's what bankers dream about every night. So what developed is that you essentially have Eurasianism on the one side, which is Putin's general ideology, and a very shallow, anomalous, very vapid consumer capitalism on the other. I've seen floating around this notion I've created this whole, Putin nationalist thing on the right. Same thing with Assad. I was praising Hafez al-Assad in 1991 as a nationalist, and I was denounced from every right-wing organization you could think of because he was a Soviet client. Well, the same thing for Putin. Until he threw the oligarchs out. And suddenly my enemies start converting. So this is my baby. I have to defend it. I have never said that Putin was a racialist or that he is defending the white race. As a consequence of his policies, that's true, yes. But that's not his motive. He's a Eurasianist. I have a strong tendency to Eurasianism as well, that Russia's future and the economic future is the alliance of Russia and China. But, you know, you have someone, really the architect of Russian so-called capitalism, which is just oligarchy, Anatoly Tsubayas, who was certainly far more powerful than Yeltsin ever was a communist theoretician just a few years before. I mean, in the late 80s, he's the editor of the journal Communist, which was a central journal of the Soviet government. And a couple of years later, he's privatizing everything as a liberal, because he's not seeing a whole lot of distinctions. They're both materialists. They're both atheists. They're both completely secular. They both worship technology, etc. And it's bizarre to say this today, but the Communist Party of the Russian Federation is an extremely healthy political party. They're Eurasianists. They're nationalists. They're Orthodox. And the reason is because Russian patriots during the Soviet Union, where they couldn't, you know, be Orthodox patriots, had to kind of channel all that into something called Soviet patriotism, which is vapid. It's nothing. But it didn't take long before Soviet and Russian became one and the same. And Putin was one of these people. Of course, going into the security services in an established government generally is for patriots. And kind of a national Bolshevism, very different from Leninism, was sort of a de facto, very inchoate ideology of most Russians. And the Communist Party follows that. The Communist Party, the Russian Federation, is not materialist. Uses Marx and Lenin really only as window dressing. They praise and romanticize the Soviet government, which, you know, is irritating and stupid. But they also have their base to worry about. Gaidar is another. Gaidar and Tsubayas were the duumvirate who ran Russia's privatization. The major players here in the early 90s are, of course, the American government, American corporate capital, Citibank especially, Harvard University, which was sort of the nodal point where all the elites met, NATO, this tiny Russian elite, Gaidar, and you know, talking about Yeltsin is almost, you know, he really was just window dressing for the most part. He wasn't very good at it. Tsubayas and Gaidar and local elites were, you know, for the Russian side. And this became a Russian genocide. It wasn't developed under Andropov or Gorbachev. It came under Tsubayas. The Soviet economy was dissolved. 80% of the Soviet economy was dissolved without a shot being fired in a few years. There is no historical example. Without any war or anything else, there is no example in history that shows anything like that occurring. The reason why liberalism and capitalism, Americanism, could never, ever take Russia is that they watched their society fall to pieces. Literally, in most cases, in the 1990s. Same thing for Ukrainians. There's a reason why even Western Ukrainians see Russia, the figures are about 60%, as a positive influence in their society. That's in Western Ukraine, according to the Kiev Institute of Sociology. But they saw things falling apart, and so Alexander Luchkoy and Volsky created the so-called civil collective, which was a national Bolshevist group, for lack of a better phrase. The Russian National Union, the Russian Church, which had been a Soviet creation, did gain some independence and was firmly national Bolshevik, you know, for very in a very broad sense of the term, politically. And a great revival of the church meant that, you know, these opposition forces were joining together. And they came together in something called the National Salvation Front, which was immediately banned by Boris Yeltsin on orders from the United States. You had these liberal parties and Harvard and Citibank in control of the Russian economy that could pull no more than, you know, 5% in terms of popularity. And they are, you know, hoisting this on Russia, and you see the newspapers saying that the capitalism has triumphed there. And they make it seem inevitable. There's no turning back now. The United States government put its money and diplomatic support behind Gaidar, and continued to do so even when these reforms not only were failures, but almost destroyed an entire people. But just like Lenin, the liberal clique needs to create a nationalist group to act as their controlled opposition. And this this man is Vladimir Zhirinovsky. I know I've mentioned him here before. I want to reiterate this. He's a phony. Now, unlike people who, you know, go on and on, people being agents and fakes with no evidence, I'm giving you evidence. He's Jewish and was a Israeli and Jewish nationalist in the 1980s. He has a Israeli passport. And Edelman is his real last name. Edelstein, sorry, is his real last name. And, you know, not only did the liberal clique have him as their nationalist leader. Oh, by the way, I apologize. It's Edelstein. It's his father's name. He's from Kazakhstan. In the 1990s, I was in graduate school, and I distinctly remember whenever the Russian people were revolting against this liberal order that was destroying everything in their society, Zhirinovsky would do something insane. Would say, "I want to kill all Latvians," or something like that. And that'd be all over the news. In other words, you better support this liberal clique or else you're going to get this psychopath. And of course, he was nothing of the kind. He was a Jewish liberal theoretician throughout the 80s. Tobias was shredding documents all over the place. The Congress of People's Deputies called for a referendum in 1993, and he called them right-wing extremists. Protesters showed up in front of the building with signs in English. Yeltsin's popularity, you know, in the early 90s was about 15%. But the U.S. said he is the new leader, the democratic choice of all Russia. A handful of protesters, he called for martial law. The decree on the special order governing the state. He needed this because Russia was in the process of being disintegrated, and he wanted to shut down any opposition as quickly as possible. Again, this is the U.S. doing this. Communist Party maybe could count on maybe a third of the vote. Its agenda, as I said, not to return to communism, but to create this Eurasianist nationalism. And the fact remains that what happened to Russia in the 1990s is far worse than anything Stalin did. It killed more people. It destroyed more lives. And it was the entire former Soviet Union, not just one place, like the Ukrainian famine. When you bring the life expectancy down to 58, that you can't do, you're completely destroying the sense of identity and everything else, infecting that country with everything bad about the West, with very little that's good. This happening, of course, he needed to create his so-called nationalist opposition on the one hand, and then make sure that martial law was right around the corner on the other hand. Now, the referendum took place, and only about, due to a lot of threats, about 60% of the electorate came out to vote. But, and Yeltsin didn't do half bad. I mean, he, of course, was very low. But this is because privatization hadn't fully taken place yet. I distinctly remember the American press saying, "Return to Stalin is possible. Return to Hitler." And they got those conflated quite often because they were calling Zhirinovsky an admirer of Hitler and Stalin at the same time. And this you know, was I knew then, of course, and no one listened to me, but now we know a lot more about the guy. But return to Hitler, yeah, we know the whole drill here. You read about the NSA talking about Russian media control, which of course does not exist. Boris Yeltsin, with U.S. support, had full state media control. The 10th Congress of People's Deputies demanded the resignation of Yeltsin and his people. He knew that he'd be convicted in any court of the criminal privatization scams that they were running. And it was Yeltsin that initiated the coup in 1993, not the National Salvation Front. The dossier on Shmyhalka, who was the prime minister at the time, and Chubais himself, Boris Fedorov, the finance minister, was substantial crimes. And in fact, at the time, Attorney General Anaya Makarov was drawing up charges against that entire clique. So war came through the back door in September of 93, where Yeltsin jettisoned the Constitution entirely. Think of what Putin is being accused of here. But the U.S. was supporting and advising and in fact controlling a completely failed politician and a completely failed state in an oligarchic, almost a feudalism, with full state media, and he ripped the Constitution up in September of 93. The Russian Supreme Court said this is illegal, of course. And the Supreme Court officially relieved Yeltsin of his duties and put Rutskoy in his place. Yeltsin said, I dismiss you. So for a while there, Rutskoy was the legal president of Russia. And by late 93, the results of privatization were becoming clear. Russia had reached the level of a third world state. And I want to note that the Pamyat, the so-called Black Hundred group, fully supported Yeltsin's coup at the time. There is some reason to believe that a faction of that group was a creation of Gaidar. It's very important to them that they have an official nationalist opposition as well as the liberal agenda. He used the state media to show an old National Socialist rally, and he said, this is Rutskoy's committee. The American press, without any criticism, lapped it up. He actually invented a Nazi threat for these guys, these communist Bolshevik nationalists who believe in the great patriotic war and all this stuff. And it was accepted uncritically by Russia specialists in the universities and in the newspapers. Yeltsin used state media to communicate with nationalists, giving them false information, trying to get them to open fire in their protests in front of the presidential palace, you know, in the Congress of People's Deputies as well. They sent out a false circular to the opposition saying that the emergency committee had taken over and we need to fight back against the forces of Yeltsin. This is from Yeltsin himself, and his group is trying to get, you know, whip up this national, okay, it's time to shoot. And it was the Secret Service, of course, who fired first. About 150 unarmed people were killed. Jewish groups there were armed to the teeth. They were financed by Gaidar. I think Chubais and Gaidar were Jews. And they armed Jewish nationalist groups and said that Rutskoy was in the process of creating another pogrom and needed to fight for survival. All told, 1,500 were killed, although the American press said about 150, and no one's ever brought to justice for this. The Orthodox Church condemned this. Whoever sheds innocent blood will be excommunicated and anathematized. But what wasn't known, it was known in Russia, but not elsewhere, that it was Yeltsin's forces who fired first. Yeltsin wins this victory, calling it the will of the people. The Rutskoy committee was defeated, called new elections and a referendum about a new constitution. He had no, you know, he not only did he rig the election, he eliminated the constitution. And under those conditions, with the full state media, armed groups
controlled by him, outside of the presidential palace. The American State Department said the election was free and fair, and they did it before the election even took place. Well, Yeltsin only won about 15% of the vote, which is, you know, probably more about 5%. And his pet, Zhirinovsky, took 23%, roughly. And the communists, only 12. Yeltsin, really at the time, was making no secret in Russian of his sponsorship of Zhirinovsky. You know, his party is called the Liberal Democratic Party. That's because he was a liberal democrat at one time, in the American sense of the term, you know, liberal democracy. That's why it's called that. He was, you know, asked to become this, you know, nationalist buffoon by Gaidar and the CIA and the State Department. The point was to get nationalists to go from legitimate groups to Zhirinovsky. And the Western press, not knowing anything, Johnson's Law is in full effect, they uncritically accepted that Zhirinovsky was a nationalist leader. No nationalist leader in Russia at the time believed he was anything but a creation of Yeltsin. But after Yeltsin's new fake constitution was written up very quickly, probably in Washington, and with purely private sector influence, only half the electorate went to the polls at all. It was accepted by 58% of the 55% of the electorate who went to the polls at all. Any other situation, of course, the U.S. would have condemned it. And it was done in an environment where there is no constitution and constant threats against that movement. So you had a dictatorship of Boris Yeltsin with the full blessing of the West in 93. Later on, the Russian version of the Federal Election Commission said that only 46% of the voters went to the polls, which would have meant that it was invalid. But Yeltsin had already granted himself total power, and America was sending money, putting money in his pockets. The U.S. State Department was aware of the vote rigging. And in fact, the local Moscow press reported an admission from an anonymous member of the American delegation saying the following. The U.S. Embassy expected electoral fraud in favor of Yeltsin, and officially the Moscow office of the USAID, to distance itself from election monitoring, which could reveal episodes of voter falsification, end quote. In other words, they knew this was going to happen. They're paying for it, but we can't be seen to be a part of it. The U.S. and through the USAID is controlling these elections. Yeltsin dismissed the Supreme Court, didn't like him, so he couldn't be tried because all the judges were sent home. The Bulletin of the Central Election Commission, in its 1994 edition, Volume 11, that the vote was completely rigged and done long in advance of the election. And even there, he got 50% of the vote. So Hillary Clinton's not the only person to lose a rigged election. But like all oligarchic systems, especially this one where it has pretty much controlled by the U.S., they fear exposure. 1995, Yeltsin's party registered about 10%. The Liberal Party of Bloko, maybe 7%. And their pet Zhirinovsky at 11%. The communists, maybe 22.3% of the vote. They won in the elections that year. But of course, the new constitution that Yeltsin wrote, or that the State Department wrote, gave him a right to cancel any measure of the Duma and to disband it at any time. Now, Tsar Nicholas II, St. Nicholas II, has been condemned to the skies for doing precisely that for the first Duma before World War I, or right, you know, 1906, 1907. Yeltsin actually barred his opponents from ever entering the Duma chambers with American money. Remember, these people they don't care about being universal. That's just propaganda. They don't care about elections. They don't care about theories of rights. They don't care about individualism. Whatever it is that will promote the agenda is good. They have no intention of being. You can't go to them and say, you supported Yeltsin, for doing exactly what Tsar Nicholas did. They'll say, yeah, we were against Tsar Nicholas in favor of Yeltsin. Don't assume that, I mean, everyone's a universalist here. They just don't care. But there was a nervousness in Yeltsin's cadre, and they created these dummy corporations to funnel money, vodka and tobacco sales in some cases. They even tried to blame it on the church at one point. And what they were doing was selling everything they could find to foreign predatory companies. In 96, the budget disappeared $9 billion. Couldn't be accounted for. But this is exactly what went to create this corrupt administration. His approval rating went down to roughly about 6%. Now, the constitution that he wrote, or the U.S. wrote, said you can't spend more than $3 million, American dollars, for a campaign. Yeltsin, of course, was using the central bank to fund his campaign in the billions, and with a lot of foreign money. Foreign exchange disappeared. Yeltsin was printing rubles all over the place. Inflation rose, and you're printing rubles with no production. The incentive for any economic elite is to very short-term gains. So in 96, Yeltsin's team met in Davos, Switzerland, and they kind of, you know, developed a strategy. Kozyrev, Chubais, Gaidar were hated by 90% of the Russian population. Chubais and Berezovsky, the media elites, were controlling both the economy and the media. And they were reporting directly to the U.S. on Yeltsin's health because he was largely incoherent, but didn't matter anyway. He's a politician. And the way that they did this is claim that either Nazis are going to take over if you don't support us to the U.S., or Stalin's take over if you don't support us to the U.S. So they go back and forth between Nazism and Stalinism. It was just an emotional image. You had a full collapse of the Russian economy. And the American bankers, knowing that the economy was gone, knowing that the currency was worthless, that they were in default, lent them $10 billion in 96. And this is one of the reasons the Communist Party developed this Eurasianist and basically Christian platform. From 1992 to 1997, the USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, gave Yeltsin and Bloko, the liberal parties, $17.4 million for electoral assistance. That includes a slew of advisors from both state and private sources sent to support the liberals. And all candidates for election under Yeltsin had to be cleared by the NSA. Essentially, a cabal of bankers, really seven men, bankers ran Russia under Tobias, economically speaking. Really, there was no state. It was just a smokescreen to cover over their own misappropriation. State had absolutely no power, but rage was directed against a government, not the economic elites who controlled everything. But the state and government agencies were great because they were able to take the blame. The bankers have sunk a lot of money into Yeltsin's campaign, but they too realized it's not going to last much longer. They begin stealing from the state. And of course, Tobias, that very same year in a speech, called the oligarchs the leading members of the Jewish community in Russia. He was so confident in Russia's weakness. And in southeastern Ukraine, as some of them, southwestern Ukraine and south central Ukraine, the Jewish elites there are calling themselves New Khazaria. It's like Bilderberg. It's an unofficial name, but it's what they're calling themselves. Well, 1997, 1998, we all know, Russia declared bankruptcy. The IMF then loaned another $10 billion, which immediately disappeared with no responsibility. This is the money that the bailouts later on were replacing here. These people were living off of aid money. The corruption here goes beyond anything. The cost of living went up by 3,000%. Alcoholism was out of control. Cases of alcoholic psychosis increased 300% until 97. The immigration to the West was everywhere. 4 million Russians were homeless. The best and brightest went to the West. Farmers were abandoning the land. This is what happened between 92 and 97. When I talk about Adolf Hitler, when I lecture about him, I usually start off my lecture something like this. I say, okay, I want you to imagine that you live in a country that had just lost several million men in a war. You have no economy. You have no currency. You have no armed forces of any kind. Your cities are rocked with riots and the police can't control them. You have a huge Soviet empire to your east. Chunks of your country have been given away. The revolutionaries have taken chunks more. No one has any faith in the political system. All right, you've just been elected chancellor. What do you do? And of course, you know, they stare at me. What could you possibly do there? A man like Hitler, a man like Putin, a man like Chung Kyi-park of South Korea. The only three examples I know of where a situation like that was handled. Korea from the Korean War, of course, Germany from World War I, and Russia from the destruction of the economy in the 90s. The Taliban attempted to do it in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, they were interrupted. Obviously, you need a very strong state. But, you know, the way that, you know, what was Putin is being condemned for was American official policy with Yeltsin just a few years ago. And it's very easy to forget. There was no legitimacy to that constitution. And people say, you know, Putin, you know, doesn't believe in a free press. Well, Yeltsin, with his American advisors, simply ripped out the constitution and wrote a new one. This is how oligarchy runs. And this is an extreme case of how oligarchy simply uses or needs a smokescreen, which is what governments are. Now, we talked about Putin here before. We can't go into that. But this is why Putin is so significant. Russia went from that to controlling American elections. But now we see with that lecture here that America not only controlled the elections, they were the elections. It is absolute fraud, but the counter-revolution is brewing thanks to you guys. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalists with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.